Hello, it's Richard here with you, bringing you a story of new beginnings. Today, it's Sarah's conversation with Kate Halfpenny, who, like many of us, dreamed of an entirely new life by the sea. But when she embarked on her sea change, it wasn't quite what she imagined.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Kate Halfpenny and her husband Chris made a sea change from Melbourne to the little beach town of Ocean Grove during the COVID lockdowns. In her new memoir, Boogie Wonderland, Kate writes about the decision to move like this. I reckon I'd earned the right to be selfish with my days and dreams. I'd worked since I was 15, paid stacks of tax, never troubled the public purse with education or schooling or the cops, had bought my parents a house, didn't text and drive, had only once had a wee in public and nobody saw. But life in a small town wasn't as easy or idyllic as Kate had dreamed it would be. And without the distractions of city life or a big job and looking after kids, Kate's marriage came into a new focus. She had to face up to a painful truth and decide, in terms of her new home and her husband, whether she should stay or leave. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Sarah.
This secret we in public, is there anything you want to say about it now that you've got the chance?
Isn't that a great way to kick off the conversation? Yes, I'm happy to discuss that. Do you wish that you hadn't asked me? It was at one of my son's cricket games at a very, very exclusive Melbourne private school, and the only toilets that they had open were the boys' ones, and they were going in and out, and I just felt like I couldn't go into that space, so I waited till everyone was out on the cricket field and had a quick wee in the rhododendrons, thinking, is this enough to get my kids expelled from private school? So there you have it. No one's ever asked me about that before.
Thank you, Kate. I think many women have a secret wee, and I'm very grateful that you shared that one with me, and I'm glad there were no further repercussions for you. This dream of a sea change that you and Chris had, why did you choose Ocean Grove?
It was a spot that, when my kids were growing up, that was really familiar to us. We had an old caravan back in those days that we used to park down at Barwon Heads, which is where, of course, the original Sea Change show was filmed. We would park it there for 3 months of the year and just hang out. The kids would ride around on bikes without helmets. You know, they'd find the bikes at the local tip for every season and leave them behind at the end. And it was just somewhere special. The kids all learned to surf there, and it was very much for me a time of easy motherhood, you know, like meals are kind of from nothing, bit of bread and butter and some ham and that'll do you. And it, for, in my mind, it was always a really fantastic time. So when we were looking to get out of the city, that area, Victoria's Bellarine Peninsula, was sort of number one for us.
One day during your first summer at Ocean Grove, you were at the beach. Your dad and your husband were both in the water. What happened?
It was a beautiful day. Dad was at 83 at the time and said to us, it's a gorgeous day, can I come to the beach with you if you're going? Yep, no problem. The beach was packed. It was heaving with summer holiday makers. And I was on my boogie board. I'd caught a wave. I was probably about 30 metres away from Dad when I saw him fall over in the surf. He was only in the shallow water, but because of his bad knees, he couldn't stand up. And the waves were literally crashing over his head in the shallow water, and his face was up to the sky. It seemed to me that time was in slow motion. You know, I couldn't get there fast enough. I ripped off the boogie board and started running, but all of a sudden, there was my husband next to him, and I thought, okay, this is good. Chris will pick Dad up and save him. I'm watching my strong, big husband trying to lift Dad up, and he was falling over as well. It looked like they were doing a sort of a clumsy, you know, bunny hop, like 50s teenagers. And, you know, Dad was still struggling to get up by the time I got there. And I said to him, you need to help me. Like, you need to stand, Dad, you're fine. It was like he was suction cupped to the ground, but I managed to haul him up to his feet and we got him to safety on the beach. And, you know, my husband was sort of smiling at me as if he thought it was really funny. And I thought, why, what's going on here? You know, I said to him, you look like you were drunk out there. And then it occurred to me, it was the most bizarre moment, he was actually drunk.
Was that completely shocking to you, Kate? Like, was that out of character as far as you knew in terms of your husband?
It was completely shocking to me that he would be at the beach with us in the afternoon, having driven my precious dad there.
Having driven you there?
Yeah, yeah. He drove us there, you know, through car parks with kids running out of trees and things, you know, all of these things that were completely wrong. And it was the most, you know, I grabbed the keys, obviously, said, I will drive home, you know, mouth like an envelope, wrapped Dad up, and we went back to our place, gave Dad a packet of chips and actually gave him a beer and then sent him on his way. I sent him home and then I went to town on my husband.
This move that you and Chris had made to Ocean Grove, this wasn't your first experience with a sea change. What had happened back in your family when you were 8 years old?
Yes, one of the most wonderful things that could happen to any eight-year-old, which was that my parents bought a motel called the Silver Sands in a little town in Tassie called Bishanoe. It's a really small fishing village, pretty daggy, you know, literally tumbleweeds in the main street. And actually, when I was a little kid, one of the most exciting things that happened was that the Leyland brothers came to the local school hall and did a little presentation, and that was really incredible, and that was enough to sort of keep everyone energised for about a year.
That's very on brand for Bishanoe in the 70s, I imagine, that it's the Leyland brothers who arrived.
Totally. Well, actually, in the other set of brothers were the Foster brothers, who were the famous woodchoppers who came once to the Bishanoe show, which was just ace, like, could not believe it. I'm seeing the Fosters, you know, shinning up the tree here on my local oval. But yeah, so Mum and Dad bought this hotel, and actually in Tassie, Silver Sands is quite iconic. We've seen old films from the 50s with Silver Sands as a holiday, you know, high spot for anyone. And so we just had the most incredible time. My two sisters were packed off to boarding school, and so my brother and I had the run of the place on our Honda 50 matching mini bikes. And
did you have to help out at the hotel?
Yes. Saturday afternoons were dedicated to, for me, folding our gold starch linen napkins into crowns, which I can still do as a party trick to this day, and popping them out on all the tables in the dining room. And my brother and I used to deliver the continental breakfasts every morning through the little hutches before we would go literally next door to the three-room primary school, where I think there were 28 students when I was there.
Do you know what had prompted your parents to make this sea change of their own? Why they left Melbourne for Bishanoe?
That actually is a great question. Which one will I? How will I answer it? Well, as Mum would tell it, I was a sickly child and had asthma, and was told that the Melbourne winters were doing me no good. But I think they actually wanted a change. Mum and Dad had worked in hotel motels since they were first married. They actually got married at 18 because they got a job as motel managers in a property called the Motel de Ville in Parkville in Melbourne. But they had to be married if they were to have the job. So they had a rush wedding in Devonport in Tassie, and that was that. So they had worked in motels all up and down the east coast of Australia, and when this opportunity came up to buy one themselves, I think they jumped at it. Dad, I think, was keener than Mum, but that's how it came about.
How did your dad try to blend in fashion-wise in Bishanoe?
Well, he decided that the clobber which he had worn in Melbourne, which included, Dad was a snappy dresser, you know, the flares of the time and the silk shirts and what have you, always down to his unbuttoned, and Dad still loves a giant pendant. He gets out of the show, pops some powder onto his chest hair, and then he pops a pendant on. That's very much his style. But once he got there, he decided that perhaps if he wanted to win over the fishermen who were out, clientele, he needed to tone that down a little bit. So the first week he took a whole suitcase of his Melbourne clothes to the tip, and the next day our handyman Alvin came in wearing Dad's purple flares and purple platform shoes. It was so unreal. My brother and I, to this day, we can say, remember Alvin's in the clothes, and we can still just laugh about it. It was so great. It was funny.
It just sounds like it was this idyllic place for you and your brother. Why did your mum and dad decide to move back to Melbourne?
I think it was the workload. You know, while while the kids were having the best time all the time, playing badminton in the conference room and on the trampoline and, you know, every summer we would get regular guests. So we always had these inbuilt friends. It was really great. But, you know, behind the scenes, Mum and Dad were just working 24 hours a day. You know, if they weren't on reception, they were in the front bar or the main bar or they were in the kitchen. You know, the chef didn't turn up, Mum would suddenly be cooking for 50 guests. And I think that very quickly that wore off. But also, Sarah, they were early experiences, I think, of sea change regret, where they never really quite fitted in. We were always the outsiders. And I think that, you know, oh, you're from the mainland. We were never accepted as locals and it just became too much.
How did you feel, Kate, about being back in the suburbs of Melbourne?
I was shattered. I was really devastated. I loved my Tassie life. So to suddenly be re-transplanted back to Melbourne, especially in the eastern suburbs, which, you know, is quite moneyed, I'd become a classic bogan in Tassie. That's just how it was. And I was really happy to be there. Yes, we were at private school down there, but it was still, our weekends were still spent very much in this little fishing village, picking blackberries and just, you know, smoking cigarettes if we could catch them and listening to AC/DC. So to be back in Melbourne was a real culture shock for me. And I was in year 10, which, as anyone who's ever been a 15, 16-year-old girl will know, is the worst time to be trying to crack into a new social group. So, yeah, I found it really hard to adjust.
You yourself got married pretty young and had kids young too. Were you always keen to be a mum yourself?
Yeah, I was. I think that Mum and Dad gave us the most beautiful, beautiful, you know, role modelling of what married life could look like. And certainly theirs was not perfect by any means. They met when they were age 5 or 6. They lived opposite each other and, as I said, married really quickly at 18. So, you know, they'd worked hard at it, 4 kids. And so for me, I think I always just wanted what they had. They made family life for us very secure and very fun. You know, like we had a great time and we're still really close. I still now just live 10 minutes away from them. Yeah, so when I met a particular boy on the beach in Surfers Paradise at age 17, and this sounds really wacky and I know it does and I'm not a woo-woo person, but I literally thought to myself, oh, there you are. Yeah, there you are, my husband.
And so he proved to be.
Yes, my brother was a couple of years behind Jay at their school and he'd come home one day and told me about a boy who disrupted the school talent quest by blowing a surgical glove up on his head. He pulled it over his face and inflated it like a sort of a rooster comb and then ran around the school hall and he told me about this bloke and we're on the beach in Surfers Paradise and he said, there's the boy with the glove on his head. And it was like a lightning bolt had struck me. Suddenly, with or without the rubber glove, I thought a voice in my head said, there you are. And we went out that night to Bombay Rock in Surfers Paradise with our fake IDs and he bought me a bit of lime and lemon and we saw Dragon live and that was our first date. And, yeah.
This is an iconic series of experiences, Kate. You were building your career in media at the same time from early on in your 20s.
Yeah, I got a job, well, a cadetship at the Melbourne Herald, which was then the broadsheet afternoon newspaper in the city straight from school. Got an offer at law school at Melbourne Uni, but the lure of the $110 a week salary at the Herald was far too much for
only
a girl.
Human.
Exactly. For a girl who liked her clothes, her sports girl pearl, fake pearls. Yeah, how would I turn that down? So, yes, from 18, and I was so naive and I was always really bad, Sarah, at hard news. I think that the chief of staff at that stage was Steve Price. Learned very early on not to call Kate into the office and talk about a hard news story. I just never understood them. And
what was your specialty then?
Always entertainment. I think about 2 weeks in, I was sent out to interview Sammy Davis Jr. I actually have a photo of that moment and I look so earnest and he's telling me, like, I think, how to live my life. I've got my notebook and my pen. I'm listening to Sammy. And from then on, it was something that I understood. I could ask people, yeah, I got entertainment, but the rest of it still goes way over my head.
Tell me, what was going on for you, Kate, when you had your second baby, Felix?
I was then 28, Sarah. I'd been working at Who magazine for a couple of years since my first son was born and I had a home office set up, which was pretty great. But when Felix was born, things started to go off tap. I think it was just the pressure of being a young woman. I have an A-type personality, so I always expect the best from myself. And, things weren't great. 2 years earlier, when my first son was little, my grandmother had died under terrible circumstances. And that, I think, created all sorts of problems for me mentally that I never really dealt with properly. So when Felix was born, I was under pressure. And then 2 years later, when my daughter Sadie was born, that's when things started to really go off track for me.
How bad did things get, Kate?
They were pretty bad. With Sades, you know, I woke up in the middle of the night one night and woke my husband. I'd had this fantastic idea about how I could let the baby know that I loved her more than anything. And I woke him and said, I think I'm going to carve Sadie's name into my face and then she will always know how much I love her. And he, you know, he pretty much said, just stay here for a minute, honey, went and locked up all the knives in the kitchen and came back and said, you know that that's a really bad idea. But to me it seemed like it was wonderful and I was surprised that he didn't get on board with it.
So you were in a pretty severe psychosis or
yes.
dissociated state or what was happening?
Yes, that's actually right. You know, that's what happened. You know, he and a friend helped get me to a hospital and to a psych ward, I guess, where the doctors were really concerned. And I think the sticking point for me was, though, Sarah, that they were always on at me to take the drugs. And this is, I'm by no means giving medical advice to anybody. This was just what worked for me. But I did try and I started on the antidepressants, but I found that they dried up my milk supply quite quickly. And that was one of the sticking points for me. If I was going to be a good mother, I was going to do everything for my children, which included breastfeeding. You know, I was going to make every meal. I was going to iron their clothes. I was going to use cloth nappies. I was going to do the whole shebang and I was certainly breastfeeding. So that quite quickly became not an option for me. So I checked out of the facility and just decided that I would push through. I mean, I'd gone back to work when Sadie was 16 weeks old and we were doing a house renovation, you know, and I had a national job at that stage. So there was a lot of pressure being brought to bear. And at that stage, I found there was not a lot of information around it or resources.
So how did you start to recover? Like, was there a moment when the grip of that lessened? What do you remember about coming through that?
Yeah, there was a moment, and to this day it's still one of my best moments in my life. We were down at the local football oval. My husband Jay had the two little boys kicking the footy. I had Sadie in her cot, and she was wearing a little pale blue sort of knobbly coat with a little matching beanie, and I was looking down at her in her pram, and for the first time in 6 months I felt a shard of happiness. It was just this amazing feeling, you know, like you see on movies when there's like a thing that hits a building and it lights up. That's how I felt. Like, it was like, I'm going to come out of this. I can still feel to this day what that felt like. I can still see those little boys kicking the footy and that little girl's face in the pram and thinking, this is going to be okay. I don't have to walk into the sea. I don't have to carve her name in my face. I'm going to get through this.
You and your husband had weathered so much together. Was it painful for that marriage to come to an end? What was that stage of your life like?
Oh, it was devastating. Yes. And what is it now? It's 13 years on. Yeah. It was really devastating because, as anyone who loses a marriage will know, it's not just your present that you're losing, it's also your future. So very much I was aware of how does this happen? You know, we had our first kiss at 17. We were then, I think, 45. So we'd been together for a really long time and had what I thought was a really good marriage. So, yeah, the end of it was devastating. And, you know, I got by I'd get the kids off to school every day and then I'd get in the bath. And when it got cold, I would run it again and again. And it was just a way of knowing you've survived another hour. When the bath went cold, I knew another hour had ticked over and I'd survived it. At one point I was working in the bath with my laptop, and then when the kids came home, I was able to say to them, all right, we've got lamb casserole for dinner, who's got homework or whatever. But, yeah, there was one particular moment when we were packing up our house together after we'd sold it, packing up the linen cupboard. Of all things, and, you know, we were putting away the little IKEA single bed duna covers with cars on them and animal faces and things, and packing up all the kids' books, and I just lost it. I thought I was going to have to go to hospital. Like, I can't do this. Just the sight of the linen that had represented when our kids were small and we were together. But he was amazing. He put it all into into cardboard boxes and wrote on it for our future grandchildren. And he said, you know, look, whatever happens, we will still do it together. And he and I are still really close. We still have a joint bank account. You know, we still hold hands in the street. We're still super proud of our children. You know, I don't look upon that marriage as a failure by any means. For me, it is a great success. It's a towering success. And it's still, it's still a love story.
So when the two of you split up, Kate, were you looking to meet someone else?
No. No, certainly not. No, that was not, no, definitely.
Well, who did your brother want to set you up with?
Yes, only 6 weeks later. Yes, he had a friend back when I was 16 and my brother Sammy was 14. He came home with this fellow one day from school who'd run away from his evil stepfather. So he showed up with a little case and I was just so annoyed by him. He had a massive blonde mullet. And it would seem to block out the light in the hallway when I was trying to do my study. And he and my brother would disappear into my brother's room. And my brother has been my longtime best friend. So suddenly I'm being usurped by this guy with the blocky head who's sitting in my brother's room. And they would sing the Alan Parsons Project, I Am the Eye in the Sky, like play it over and over again. And I remember saying to this newcomer once, like, oh, God, you're so big, get out of the hallway. And he said, look at you with your stumpy little legs just studying all night, every night. It was pretty funny. Anyway, after 2 weeks, my dad said, I think it's time you went home and faced the music, mate. So off he went. Anyway, that, you know.
This is your initial introduction.
This is my initial introduction to the man who, you know, 6 weeks after my first husband has left me. My brother said to me, you need to have some fun. And he said, the most funny person I know is my friend Chris from school. I went, oh, that guy, I haven't seen him for such a long time. What's he doing? He said, yeah, I don't know, but he's really funny. So my brother organised a dinner for us with the, you know, the giant mullet blocky head boy.
Did he still have the giant mullet?
No, he was totally bald. The mullet was gone, which I think is a good thing because he has a beautifully shaped head, so I think it's better. So he set up this dinner. My brother did not show up for the dinner, claimed that he had his daughter's ballet recital or some such. And anyway, I invited Blocky Head Man over to my place. He actually said to me after the dinner, you know, I don't know if it's true that you and Jay have broken up, but if it's true and you need an impartial listener, he said, I'm a grouse listener and an amateur movie critic. I could come round with a movie. I thought, actually, that sounds pretty good because I don't know anyone else who's been divorced or has ended a long relationship will know this, but people take sides. They've been so invested in the brand of you as a married couple that they invariably feel like they need to take sides. And certainly with brand Kate and Jay imploding, people were in panic, like, he'll come back to you or you could do this or do that. And, you know, I didn't know who to talk to about my absolute grief. So the idea of someone that I didn't really know from Adam sounded great. Anyway, he came over for Saturday dinner. I was really nervous. I cooked pasta, which I think I had on the stove for maybe 7 hours, a zucchini and mushroom pasta. And we ended up dancing to the Best of Air Supply on vinyl, the Reader's Digest edition, and yelling all out of love to each other. And he came upstairs with me and that was it. I told him I loved him on that first date.
That you loved him?
I told him I loved him. We'd been writing to each other during the week, you know, planning on him coming over. And his writing was so beautiful. It was like nothing I'd ever had, certainly from any man before, let alone anyone ever. It was perfect. It was heaven. And for someone like me who values words, I thought, this man's amazing. Yeah. So when he was actually in my house and I don't know, I told him that I loved him on that first date. He looked at me like, you are such a weirdo. It took him a week to say it back. But he claimed that he felt it on the first night. He just thought, this can't possibly be right. What's happening here?
How big a part did drinking play in the way you spent your time together?
Massive. Yes, from that first night. So the first I Love You night, we were certainly drunk on that night. And alcohol was a really fantastic third wheel in our marriage. You know, if we were making dinner together, we'd splash each other a glass of wine or, you know, we had what we called our Sunday sessions, 1:30, we'd kick off with some cocktails, get down to our undies and have a little kitchen disco and ha ha ha, make each other laugh. And yeah, it was always there for us. And we plundered numerous resort bars around the world, the swim up bars. And that was actually where we decided we would move in together. We were in a Thailand swim up bar one day and I was talking about having to buy a new house for the kids. And Chris said, why don't we combine our money and buy a rock star place together? We're like, okay, great. Ha ha, another caipirinha. Yeah. So many of our big decisions were made while we were half cut at least. I didn't feel like we drank to excess. I would probably only have one glass during the week, but on Friday nights, yeah, we would get our dog. We had a whole number of places in Collingwood where we lived where we could go out with our dog Maggie, pubs which would let her in, and pinball arcade places, you name it. We were there with our dog and our drinks. It was really fun and we were the party house. People would ring us and say, we're 10 minutes away, there's 20 of us. You know, have you got any cheese? We'll bring the booze. Like, unreal. We would race around lighting candles and spraying air freshener and, welcome everyone. So, yeah, it was a good, happy, social thing that we did and it felt very much like it was normal and it was under control.
Whose idea was it to make a sea change of your own, to leave Melbourne for Ocean Grove?
We'd been talking about it for a while, but in our minds it was going to be, you know, a 5 or a 10 year project. We felt like we still had work in the city, you know, that's where our jobs were, our kids were there, we loved the place where we lived. So definitely we had it in the back of our mind that that could be something which would be a great move. We had a massive mortgage because, you know, divorce financially ruined us, but that was manageable on 2 salaries. That was okay. But yeah, after COVID, when things changed for everyone and I made a terrible job decision and our beautiful new build, incredible rock star apartment, and, you know, it leaked for the 5 years, 6 years that we were there, which caused endless problems. And, you know, there was just a day that I turned to Chris and said, I'm done here. Like, let's leave town.
So you found this beautiful house that you both loved near the beach at Ocean Grove. Did those early weeks feel like you were on permanent holiday?
Absolutely. Yes.
How amazing. Would you spend your days?
Oh, I would just do what I did as a kid. Growing up in Bishan, I'd grab my banana lounge and a great book and some snacks, like rummage in the Quality Street tin that had been left over from Christmas, and set myself up for the day. And, you know, Chris would be working and he'd come out at about 5 and say, cocktail, darling, like, absolutely. We'd get in the blow-up Clark rubber pool together with our cocktails and the radio and listen to the cricket or whatever we were doing. And we had a massive garden. We had garden on 3 sides, so we were buying lawnmowers, we were buying plants. We just were loving ourselves so much. So, yeah, it was endless happy hour at our house.
You did run around the block naked one night, though, Kate Halfpenny. What was that about?
Yeah, can you tell me? Because I don't even understand it myself right now.
This puts the public wee in the shade.
It really, actually, it really does. Oh, does it? Which is worse? I don't know. Which is worse, nude 55-year-old or weeing? You make up your mind, dear listener. Yeah, like we felt really bored after a little while in Ocean Grove. You know, there's not that much to do in small towns once, say, 5 o'clock hits. Everyone scuttles inside to watch the Chase Australia and, you know, make their, you know, their mince dinner or what have you. So we were just chucking a tennis ball in the front yard one night and laughing about stuff. We're half cut again. And I just said, you know, like, this place is so deserted at this time of night. I could run around the block in the nude and no one would see me. Chris was like, I dare you. And I'm a really competitive person. I can't stand being bested in anything. So I was like, I'm going to do it. He's like, do it. I'm going to do it. Okay, do it. So I did it. I peeled off my clothes, I put my ASICs on, and I ran around the block in the nude, and as far as I know, nobody saw me.
After you and Chris had moved to Ocean Grove, he got a call while you were driving together. What had happened?
Yeah, we'd been to get our eyes checked in Geelong, which is a pretty, actually, that was quite a fun outing for us at that stage. We were looking for entertaining things to do in our beach town. Yeah, driving home, and his Aunt Felicity rang us and said, you know, where are you? In the car. She said to him, are you driving? And he said, yes. She said, is Kate with you? Yes. She said, can you pull over? And, you know, like even then I knew, and I think that he did, that something terrible had happened. And it turned out that his lovely brother John, this was just a normal Saturday morning, had gotten up that day. John was 59. He told his wife Maria that he'd had a bad leg cramp overnight. So, you know, he rummaging around in the bathroom for the deep heat, and she said to him, look, don't worry about coming up to get the bread and the newspapers. I'll take the dog. I'll do it myself. And when she got home, he had died. He'd texted his daughter to make plans for that afternoon and made himself a coffee, and he died.
What had happened to him, Kate?
Yeah, we didn't find out for a long time afterwards, again, because it was COVID. There was a big backlog, so it took a long time to get answers, Sarah, but it turned out that he'd had a DVT, which he'd actually known about for a while, but again, during pandemic, especially in Melbourne, you couldn't get to see doctors, and it was really hard to get any treatment for anything. So he'd ignored it for that time, and yeah, that was ultimately what killed him.
And in the car that day when you heard your husband get that news about his brother, what do you remember seeing?
It was like his face, something changed in it forever, and that sounds dramatic, but that's exactly what happened. When Lissy was telling us, it's John, John has died, his face just, it changed. It was like a candle just melting very subtly, and his initial response was to say, well, where is he? Is he okay? I'll go to the hospital. We'll get there. And then Lissy had to say again, he's died. And just watching my husband hear that terrible news. You know, John was his hero growing up. He's a very cool bass player. Chris's dad left home when Chris was two, so John was very much not just his brother but also his male role model. So actually being with him in that moment was a terrible privilege. I'm so glad that I was there, but, you know, I know for him in that instant that things changed forever.
How did his behaviour change at home after that loss?
Well, he started, you know, long story short, the grief that he felt over that and the isolation that he was feeling living in a place which was naturally very beautiful, but if you're not boogie boarding, not that much else to do. So he was awash with boredom. He was now awash with grief, and he started drinking really heavily, most of it in secret. You know, he would have a bottle of rosé in front of me at night, but he was also secretly drinking at least half a bottle of vodka every day.
So all of this leads up to that day on the beach where your father got into real trouble in the surf and Chris was too drunk to be able to help him get up again. What happened that afternoon when you confronted Chris about the drinking?
We had a really ugly scene. You know, Dad had gone home and Chris was he was still in denial about it. It's not that big a deal. Yes, I've been doing it all summer. You haven't noticed. It's, you know, what's the problem? Are you the police? Are you my mother? It was pretty awful, and it spilled out onto our front lawn, and we had this really weird wrestle. And this is not great to say, and I'm not proud of it, but I was punching him. You know, he had his arms very firmly down to his side, like not touching me, but I was throwing punches at him, and we'd done boxing together before, so I knew what I was doing. I just had this terrible pain and frustration and anger, like, you've been putting me in danger all summer. You know, he admitted that all summer he'd been driving me around to our daily boogie boarding session, sometimes twice a day, up to the shops, whatever, drunk. So I felt this mixture of how could I not know this? I'm a trained observer of people. How did I not know? Yeah, so we I don't even know how long this went on for. I mean, it was bad enough that I had to ice my hand afterwards, but I just said to him, you've got to go, leave, I can't look at you. So he grabbed a bag and trudged off into the darkness, and I had no idea where he was going or, more importantly, where we were going. You know, where did this leave us? What did it mean for us and for our marriage?
Whose idea was it for him to go to rehab?
It was my idea. I spoke, you know, I didn't know who to turn to because it's really hard as a middle-aged, middle-class woman to say to anybody, oh, yeah, this husband that I love so much and we had that great wedding and promised to love each other forever, he's actually an alcoholic and, you know, I don't know what's happening to our marriage and to his health. It was very hard, but I fortunately had a glorious friend who was a psychologist, and I was able to ring her and say, what do I do? And she researched rehab centres for us and found one which had a therapeutic approach as well as the physical detox. It's in Sydney, and she said this would be great for him. So when I texted Chris 3 days after our, you know, our front yard wrestle and said, come home now, we need to talk, I said to him then, I think you need to go to rehab. I'm not giving you the ultimatum, but I am telling you that if you don't go, we're not going to be together in 5 years' time. That's it. So it's your choice. And fortunately, he agreed to go.
What were the weeks leading up to him going into rehab, checking himself in like?
Really hard, because it was, you know, he was trying every trick in the book by then to get out of going to rehab. So he would vary between, I haven't had a drink today, I'm completely fine, I don't need rehab after all, to he would just get absolutely hammered. And he would say things to me like, you know, to try and wound me, to, I think, to drive me away. He would say things like, oh, I love vodka way more than I love you. He said to me one day, you've kept my interest more than any other woman, but I'm not interested in you on any level anymore, physically, emotionally, sexually. And it was very, very hard in those instances just to hang in there. But I knew that this was not my beautiful Chris. I knew that he was still in there somewhere, but this was not my husband. It was another man who looked like him. So, you know, we just hung in there, and the weekend before he was setting off to Sydney, we went to the Foo Fighters concert down in Geelong, their first gig back in Australia, and they were playing 20 minutes up the road from us. Like, how does that happen? So, you know, we went off there, and I had a great night with my brother singing along, and my memory is of Chris just smashing the Canadian clubs and, you know, looking really grimly. He knew he was about to break up with his best friend in the whole world, and for me, by that point, I could not get him on that plane fast enough.
Once he had gone, Kate, what was it like for you at home?
It was wonderful. It was really great. It was incredible to not have to worry that my husband was killing himself. I mean, I was obviously concerned about what he was going through up there in rehab, but a lot of it was really great for me. I had peace. I had time to think about what I needed for me, you know, because what I'd found during that period was, you know, that the mathematics of marriage are tricky because I was having to give him what I needed myself most. You know, we'd come down to Ocean Grove because I needed to get away. I needed a break. It was my turn to be looked after, and the opposite had happened. So I felt absolute anger with him. I felt frustration with him. And I also wondered if I still loved him. You know, more than once I found myself Googling, how do you know if you still love someone? You know, hoping that the tech world would deliver me an answer. Because at that stage, I just wasn't sure what it was going to look like. You know, if he came back to me sober, would I still like him? Would he like me? Alcohol had been such a huge part of our lives. And what did that look like once we no longer had that lubricant and that sort of that glitter dust-making thing in our life? So we spoke almost every night. It was a very restrictive model of rehab where he wasn't allowed to have his mobile phone, no books, no exercise, no television, no sugar, no cigarettes, no alcohol, no anything. So it was like he was in prison where they'd ring and say, we have Chris Oeg on the phone for you and we got our 10 minutes and that was it. So a lot of that time was spent with him saying he was unhappy, and I don't know, but for me it was just a, I can breathe and see my way through this and try and work out what's next. You know, it was the first time in my entire life that I had had a house to myself without pets, without husbands or parents or siblings or children or anyone. And it was a really, really wonderful time where I could read what I wanted to and try and decide what I wanted. But, you know, it was also quite bittersweet because it brought into sharp relief the fact that my life had moved so quickly. 30 years had gone in the blink of an eye, and it was the first time that I didn't have children at home. So not only was my husband not around, my kids weren't around. I only had a really old dog to look after. And it is all of those questions about who do I want to be. I found that what came up for me was that I had spent most of my life waiting for something to happen. You know, you wait to finish school, you wait to find the person, you wait to have a baby and get a job and build a career and buy a house. You do all the waiting. I felt like very much that that waiting had brought me to a point where it was now time for action. I was sick of waiting. It was up to me now to take action about what I wanted, whether the sea change was right for us, whether I even wanted to be married anymore.
So while you were in this version of yourself at home and having the chance for the first time in your life, as you say, to really have space to think back about the life that you'd lived so far and what might be ahead, Chris comes home. What were things like when he came home from that stint in rehab?
They were super weird. You know, he'd been in therapy and it was trauma-based therapy, so they were dragging up everything that had ever happened to him, and a lot had happened to him, a lot of trauma, and so that was their way of treating it. Let's bring it all back up again. And
you're not sounding convinced here.
Oh, hey. I think it was a terrible, terrible model. You know, again, maybe it works for some people, but for my beautiful husband, that did not work. And I think that I knew from the day that he got back that things were pretty shaky, and I didn't think that he was very well. I in fact, found his mental state worse when he came back. Yes, he wasn't drinking, which was a massive tick, but I found him lacking in confidence. I found him unhappy. And our communication became really stilted because he'd had 3 weeks in therapy. We were prefacing things with, may I share a reality? Instead of just saying to him, you forgot to get the milk, or, you know, when are we going to have sex again? It was, may I share a reality? And so it's like living, we were just tiptoeing around each other politely. It was very strange. It was a weird time.
So were you almost waiting for him to relapse? Did it feel like you were kind of on eggshells waiting for this? Did it feel like an inevitability almost?
Oh, yeah. I was like Inspector Clouseau. Like, if he left the house, I would rummage through his stuff to try and find bottles. Is he drinking again? You know, one morning when I came out and he was just drinking orange juice from the carton, and I thought, oh, has he poured something into it? I was really suspicious, and that was making me into a nervous wreck. You know, I had turned back into the fun police and the detective. I was literally, he does not know this, but one day I spent an hour trying to crack into his bank account to see if he'd been buying booze. So I was always looking for it, and I think that he knew that it was inevitable too, that he wasn't fixed, that the rehab was not right for him, and that he wasn't ready at that stage to give up alcohol. And I think that's really important for anyone who is a support person or who is going through it. You can't do it until you're ready, but that day is going to come. You know, alcoholics know they're great liars, and they know each other better than anyone knows them. They know that they need to give up, but they can't do it until the time's right.
So when he did start drinking again and you realised and he couldn't hide it anymore, how did you react?
Initially devastated again and kicked him out again. I tried to enforce these cursed boundaries that people tell you about. Everyone says you must put boundaries in place. How do you put boundaries in place with someone that you love and you want to be living with them forever? You can't say, I forbid you from drinking, or I forbid you from drinking on weeknights. We'll only drink on weekends, and we'll only have 2 drinks at a time. I felt like I was at my wit's end. So in the end, I just said to him, do you know what? If you want to drink again, start drinking. Let's just start drinking again and see where that leads us. And that's what we did.
And how did that play out?
Pretty badly. Like, it was great in that it was no longer my responsibility. You know, if he went up to town to stay a couple of nights because he was in the office that week, I felt relieved. I figured that he was drinking in the city, but, you know, like, we didn't really talk about it. It just stopped being an issue. He was, you know, I could see the difference in him physically. Everyone could, and I think certainly he could as well. But my realisation was very much that I can't drive this. And a close friend of mine, Gaz, said to me, you have to know this is not about you. And at first that felt very personal, and offensive. How can it not be about me? This is my life as well. But he was right. It was not about me. It was totally about Chris and how he saw himself in the world and why he needed alcohol. And it was just easier to let it go.
So what was it that made Chris himself decide that he needed to give up drinking?
I wish he was here to answer that. I know, you know, he has been asked it and he said that two things, that he had put me through enough and that he was going to destroy the marriage, but also because he thought he was going to die. He was at that point, you know, half a bottle of vodka a day plus a bottle of rosé. That's a lot of booze day in, day out. And, you know, he'd had John die suddenly. I think for a while he almost wanted to chase him into the grave. I don't know if he thinks that, but that for me felt like what was happening. But then he decided, on the other hand, to honour John's death and to live while John couldn't.
How is he with you talking about it like this, writing about it, Kate?
He is extremely generous, Sarah, in, I don't say letting me do it. It's not a case of, you know, giving that permission, but certainly he's given his blessing to it and he has supported this the whole way through. We were talking about it yesterday, actually. He rang me when I was at the airport and just, you know, at the gate and said, I love you so much. I'm super proud of you. And I said, look, you know, it's funny that we're talking now and I'm not in front of you, but I feel like you've been quiet this week with the book being released. Do you feel vulnerable? Do you feel exposed? How can I help you? What can I do for you? He said, I feel all of those things. How can I not? You know, he's a manager at a well-respected Australian business. Not many middle-class, middle-aged men are able to come out and say, I'm an alcoholic. There is a stigma attached to it, and I think there shouldn't be. Alcoholism is a disease. Cancer or diabetes are diseases, so is alcoholism. This is not a choice people make, to drink and to be addicted. So I am just gobsmackingly proud of him, and I think that it's given him the permission to throw off the burden of being that. He doesn't have to pretend anymore. He's certainly not a crusader. He's not putting himself forward and saying, I did this and, you know, everyone should do it. But he does say, I did it so anyone can do it. You know, my addiction was really strong. I've beaten it. Anyone can do it. And he said to me on the phone, I'm really proud of myself. And he's not a fella to say that kind of thing. So hearing that, it was just like, I feel like we're doing a good thing. I think it's 33% of Australians struggle with alcoholism in some form. And if it starts a conversation, that's great, because I get a lot of people say to me, how do I know if I'm drinking too much? And the answer is, if you're asking the question, you probably are. And if it is impacting your relationships, your job, your health, your happiness, it's probably time to have a look at your relationship with it.
So Chris managed to build, is building this very different relationship with alcohol, and the second stint in rehab went much better than the first one. But, you know, in terms of your relationship, the two of you had begun in a blur of booze and sex. What's it been like having a sober husband?
It's been really calm. It's been really calm. There's less cosplay, I'm going to be honest about that, which I am very sad about, but I still have hope that we can reignite that one day. But, yeah, he went off to rehab again at the start of last year, so he hasn't had a drink since February 27, 2024, which is massive for someone who was drinking every day to oblivion. So it is weird, you know, like he is the most funny person I've ever met. I say black sense of humour, pink heart. But there definitely is a period of readjustment, and I found that, you know, because with so many of us, alcohol is the lubricant for our discussions and, yeah, our sex life, our romances, our fun, our relaxation. And so to not have that and to actually be only sober with each other, sometimes it's a bit boring. I still miss, and I know he does too, that little, when you sit down together and have two drinks and there's that little sparkly bit and, you know, you start talking and that feels really lovely. I miss that, but oh my God, I would not swap it for the beautiful peace that we have. Going off to sleep with a husband who I know is not going to wake up in the morning with a pounding headache and a hangover that lasts till 1 o'clock when he has more poison to stop feeling that bad. I love it, and it's really lovely. Like, I love him so much. I really do. And I just feel so glad every day that we hung in there and that I was willing to put up with whatever he threw at me, and he did. But, I mean, he was also suffering at the same time. It was no picnic for him. But we love each other madly, and I couldn't be more proud of him. So if we're a little boring, I'll take it.
There's always naked running in your arsenal should you need it. This change in your relationship, you know, it was partly kickstarted by the move away from Melbourne to this different sort of life at Ocean Grove. Does that feel like home for you now? Do you call it, is Ocean Grove home? Is that how you describe it?
Such a good question. And I ask myself this every day. Look, I really like it down there. I don't think of it as home, or maybe I don't think of it as a permanent home. There is so much about it that gives us great joy. The beach, obviously, like that is a huge lure for me, having grown up in that wonderful childhood spot of Bishanoe. Like, I feel wrapped that I'm back by the sea again, that I found my way back there. But we still miss the city. Chris goes up a couple of times a week and has his fix of it. And lately I've been doing that with him. And I do feel very much still like a city girl. I love getting my heels on. I love putting on a great dress. I love all of that. And I feel very much like that is me, which is funny because for a long time I thought of myself as a Tassie fishing village bogan, you know, like in my mind forever. So to find out, oddly enough, maybe I'm not, maybe I'm a Melbourne city girl, it's interesting.
You talked about that space of solitude and reflection that you had in a new way when you found yourself at home alone and wanting to move into action, a different kind of action. When you think about this next phase of your life, what sort of action springs forth in your mind?
Oh, like so much. I want, like, I'm falling in love with you. I want you and I to go to Romania and do some hiking.
Fantastic.
Like, yeah, all of that. Like, I want it to be packed with great stuff. And, you know, I remember when I was younger looking at my nans, who were probably only 50 at the time. And at that stage, the 50s, you know, seemed like you had a lilac perm and you had Becks in your handbag and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I don't see that at all. I feel like this stage of my life, what I've been through with my marriage, what I know about addiction, what I've discovered about my husband and his strengths and my own in that time, like, I'm finding this a really liberating phase. And that started with the chaos of menopause as well, where for me it is a huge time of liberation. Messy, yes, but I want to do all of that. I want to still go and hike the world. I still want a really big life. It's probably not as intentional yet as I would like, because I feel like Chris and I are very much in that phase of rebuilding and building that calm into our life organically. But then I'm going to be blasting off. I've got so many plans. I hope to be a grandmother. I want to give up cooking altogether. I would not care if someone came in and removed my kitchen while I was away. I'm hoping to give up Botox. Like, that is a plan that I have. I'm learning the piano. I want to learn to play the Rocky theme. So, yeah, I have plans.
Kate, I'm very excited to hear them, and I'm so happy that this stage of your story has the happy ending that it does. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
I'll see you, Sarah, at the airport for Romania.
Let's go.
Great.
Kate Halfpenny's memoir is called Boogie Wonderland. This conversation was recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples and produced by Alice Moldovan. Our executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanofsky. Thanks for listening.